We had a really good class, I think, this morning. We talked about a lot of things. If you're not in the habit of coming for class, you should come. And I think it will help to even bring the lesson home further. We're still in our series on Joseph, a man of principle. But today's lesson I've entitled Confrontation. We heard the reading earlier by Andrew, and it seems a little bit tense. There's something going on here. Last time, when we were together, we saw Joseph on the rise. He'd been taken from the rags of a pit and arrayed in the finest clothes in a palace. All of this because Pharaoh was powerless. No one could understand the message he'd been given in a dream. Not any of his wise men could answer that problem. In fact, he had two versions of the same dream. But real power belongs to God. He deems that only through Joseph the dreams will be revealed. God has a plan even bigger than the famine that Joseph predicts. The famine is just one piece of a plan to create a nation to reach out to the rest of humanity. But first, this fledgling nation has to survive a drought. The wisdom that Joseph demonstrates with God's help in advising on the dream is above that of mankind. Pharaoh recognizes that in no one else will the wisdom to carry out the suggested plan be found. Save for 7 good years, so that in 7 bad years you will be able to survive, even if it doesn't mean you're going to prosper. At this point in his life, Joseph has tried to leave behind the hurt that he felt in Canaan. He names his first son, "He who helps me to forget," recalling that God had helped him forget the old days. He names his second son in recognition that God had made him fruitful in this new land. He was, for all intents and purposes, Egyptian. But if he was Egyptian, he was once again God's inside man, ready to heed God's purposes for his life. But his new life isn't all without conflict, both external and internal. Joseph is no longer the 17-year-old know-it-all. He is now in a new, powerful, and privileged life, but he's about to come face to face with that old life again. He's about to open all those old wounds that his family, most specifically 10 of his brothers, represent. This is a story, the old story of what goes around comes around. We often can get a fresh start at things, but it's not always easy. What we left behind catches up with us sooner or later, and true resolution is a hard thing to find. As this story reopens, you can open your Bibles to Genesis 42 as we go through it. Jacob, who has been a poor role model and a passive father since Joseph's story began to unfold, finally, once more, takes initiative as the patriarch of the family. He knows there's food in Egypt. We're not surprised, since we're told the famine has left all countries dependent on the goodwill of Egypt, where there is plenty. Jacob chastises these grown men. "Why are you all standing around doing nothing? Do you want us to starve?" I hear him saying. "Go to Egypt and buy grain." But only 10 brothers are allowed to go. One brother's life is too valuable. Benjamin is not only the baby of the family, he's all that's left to Joseph of Rachel, his beloved wife. She died in giving life to Benjamin. Her eldest, Joseph, had been taken away from him with the duplicity of his other sons. Benjamin is all he has left of her, so he must be protected at all costs. And so it is that the 10 brothers who had sent Joseph to Egypt to get rid of this nuisance now travel themselves that very road and for their very lives. His life was sold out. Now their lives must be bought back. Isn't that how a God of reversals works? Joseph is governor, vizier, second in command to Pharaoh only. He had men all over the country reporting to him, managing these stores of grain that we learned were immeasurable in size. But it's documented historically that men in his position could be very hands-on. They did things like testing water in a city. They were very modern in Egypt. And it appears that Joseph was just like that. And that leads to his brothers coming directly before him, along with all the other foreigners to buy food. In all that great country, they show up right before Joseph. Joseph's clean shaven, probably including his head. He's dressed in high Egyptian clothing, looking every bit the Egyptian vizier. He speaks Egyptian. He has been long since forgotten and even put out of mind by these 10 men. The very deception of their father has helped to close that chapter of their lives. So while Joseph immediately recognizes them, they don't know him. The author repeats it twice for emphasis. Joseph is acting in full knowledge, they in complete ignorance. And that sets up the crux of our conflict today. Joseph's first and base instinct is anger. We're told he treated them like strangers and spoke harshly to them. Did he do that to everyone? Everyone who came to look for food? It doesn't seem likely. But here he has an agenda. He wants to know specifically about the situation of his father and of Benjamin, his full brother. He does not trust these other brothers of his. Can you really blame him? Where do you come from? They answer, Canaan. We only came to buy food. But that takes him back. It leads him to remember this land that he's chosen to forget. He remembers his dreams. Dreams in which the brother sheaves, and even the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to him. Whether it's in full knowledge or unconsciously, Joseph invents a charge that will put fear into their hearts and eventually bring about a day when they will bow before him in submission. You are spies. You've come to find the weakness in the land. Without saying it directly, he accuses them of threatening the state of Egypt. A man by the name of Martin Schlimm writes of this situation. At the outset of the Joseph narratives, the text says that Joseph's brothers were unable to speak to him peaceably. And now an editorial side note. Remember when we talked about the envy they held against Joseph over their father's preferential treatment and the resentment they harbored? Now the tide has turned. So Schlimm goes on. With calculated revenge, Joseph now speaks harshly with them. He falsely accuses them of being spies several times, despite the brothers' pleas to the contrary. They protest. They're only here. They're migrants looking only to buy food. They are all brothers. They mention a father. They are honest men. They are in servitude to this great Egyptian. They've never been spies. And Joseph interrupts. He knows they're telling the truth about all of this, save for one thing. They are not honest men. they've been harboring a lie for some 20 years. This lie to their father and the sin against Joseph and God is now coming to its fruition. Joseph pronounces judgment. You are here to see how naked and exposed our land is. His intimidation tactics work. They blurt out more than they should. We are brothers, sons of one man, which is okay as far as it goes, but then they foolishly add, there were 12. The youngest is with our father, and one is no more. What they say is loaded with irony. One is no more, yet it is Joseph they now stand before. At this point, they confirm they have bought into that lie. One is no more. Their lack of honesty about himself still affects Joseph. Can he trust that their story about Benjamin is true? He is the one man who can completely expose them. So he presses his point. I can see him saying, I know spies when I see them. No, you are spies. It's a rallying cry that would sit well with the Egyptians. There's long been discord between Egypt and Canaan, and such a large contingent coming for food is certainly unusual. We know, of course, they pose no threat to Egypt. So does Joseph. But retaliation still lives in his heart. This is how you'll be tested. One of you shall go and bring your youngest brother as proof. All the rest of you will be held here as a bond and as a pledge. If the youngest brother appears, you will be vindicated. But if he does not, you will be proven to be spies. And again, the God of reversals has made the strong weak and the weak strong. So long ago, Joseph was judged by his brothers on account of Jacob's preferential treatment. On the basis of that faulty judgment, he was condemned. Then again, after that, Joseph was falsely accused by Potiphar's wife and thrown into prison. And now it is Joseph, on the basis of a false accusation he's fully aware of, that has these brothers thrown into prison. What's going through Joseph's mind? There is anger, certainly. There's probably a desire for retribution. I think he's still struggling with his emotions toward these brothers. But somewhere deep down, there's also concern. Concern for a father he lost. Concern for a brother he feels maybe feeling the same contempt he felt. He leaves these brothers in prison for 3 days just to let their anxiety grow, I think. And what seems to me to be a tactic to further harass them, Joseph brings them back and offers instead that only one must remain. Which one will it be? Joseph holds himself up as both the holder of their fate, your lives depend on the outcome of this test, and on his own integrity. God will show us the answer, and I will follow the appropriate course. They must have been terrified. In truth, his concern for his father and his brother at home, along with his plan, from a practical standpoint, meant that 9 men could carry much more food back than could one. If his primary plan is to help his father and brother, this is his best course of action. If his assertion of power over them assuages any feelings of resentment, doesn't seem to come to the fore. He is still the hard Egyptian governor. And now we hear from the brothers. They too are thrown back to that time. We haven't been told previously in the narrative that Joseph had been in anguish and pleaded with them. Now they're about to lose another brother. They begin to feel the grief they so callously avoided back then. Reuben once again stands up for the right, but it seems a bit hollow and self-seeking. His chance to show leadership was back then. He mentions blood. We're reminded there's much more to blood than just a liquid in the body. It represents life. We stole that life, they say. Now we have to repay it with another. But our author, in a call to us, lets us know that it is affecting Joseph now. They don't think he understands them because he's using an interpreter. But he hears their regret in his own native tongue. We aren't told exactly why, but Joseph has to step away and he weeps. Is it the news that his father and brother are safe? Is it all those old emotions, anger and resentment from that time so long ago? Is it the stress in treating them so harshly? Or is it honestly love for them beginning to open his heart? Probably a combination of all those things. Whatever it is, he once again regains his composure and he is decisive. His actions don't demonstrate that reconciliation is yet in his heart. He chooses Simeon and has him bound right in front of the others. And then he calls his own man to carry out a plan. Send grain. Replace the money in their sacks. Is this generosity or another test of their honesty? When they reach the inn after their first day of travel, one of them discovers that his money is back in his sack. The author tells us their hearts failed them. They finally realize God's hand in this. He has executed punishment for their sins. If they return, they will be said to have dealt treacherously with the vizier. With some degree of cowardice, they opt to continue on. The others don't even open their feed sacks, perhaps out of fear of what they might find. And they return to Canaan and tell Jacob the story. They leave out some of the details. They don't tell him that they were in danger of all being held. They speak only of the outcome, that Simeon has been left in prison in Egypt. And now they finally empty the sacks of grain and find that each one has had his money returned. They stare at each other and the silver in fear. Jacob is traumatized. He blames them for this end. Joseph is gone. Simeon is gone. Now you want to take away Benjamin? What will I do? And once more, Reuben stands up. You may take the lives of my two sons if I do not bring Benjamin back. Two lives for one. But Jacob is not to be consoled. Benjamin may not go. If anything happens to him, Jacob says he would go to his grave in sorrow. You may be thinking, wait, you can't stop there. We know the story has a much happier ending, and so it does. But for now, I'd like to leave it while we examine the trouble of this family at its peak. Jacob is sorrowful, dare I say depressed, to the point of despondency. The brothers are paralyzed by their father's predicament. Benjamin is a pawn in Joseph's game. Simeon is languishing in jail. Only Joseph thinks he has control of the situation. But of course he doesn't. He has not yet learned to forgive as he must to reconcile this family. Where does that leave us? What does it say about these brothers? The ten have been living comfortably with a lie for 2 decades, but now they see it crumbling about them. Reuben, for his half-hearted attempts at leadership, has failed. He's not going to be able to carry the family forward. Simeon and Judah, next in line, they've ruined any claim they have by the cowardly reprisals against Shechem over the rape of their sister Dinah. The other sons of Leah are never even mentioned by name. Benjamin, he's the youngest, he's not under consideration. The sons of the handmaidens have never stood in line to head this family. So who is going to pull this family out? What of Jacob? He's lost control of this family, first by playing favorites, and now, as the sons have noted, to the workings of God. He sees no hopeful future. All he can do is cling to Benjamin. He acts like an ostrich, thinking that by ignoring things, they'll go away. He has sacrificed Simeon for the good of the family. But there's no resolution. And that leaves Joseph. He lives the great life of vizier. He waits for the return of his brother Benjamin to see any outcome. Yet he has still not learned what true forgiveness is. His harsh treatment of them is still a reaction to the suffering at his brother's hands. And of course, at the real center of the action is God. He is content to let this play out as the entire family learns the true meaning and cost of reconciliation. Isn't that how God always works? Aren't we all people who have to recognize our own shortcomings and failures before we can truly love others with all their baggage? Jesus says we need to take the log out of our own eye before attempting to judge others. He says if we want to make an acceptable offering to God, we must first find the way to be made right with each other, even with someone who has something against you. Not just that you have something against them. You must be like God and reach out to someone who is harboring resentment or anger towards you, even if your actions are not reciprocated. Be a peacemaker. God can only work with hearts that are ready to give up on selfish ways and follow him in full submission. We've been looking at the failings in Jacob's family, how these people need to learn what true love costs. The church is a family too, and sometimes it's dysfunctional. But what must mark the church is that we recognize our need for openness and transparency and letting go of self, that we give ourselves to God's control. That's something still being learned by Jacob's family. It's something we need to learn as the family of God. God works most mightily in a family that stops hiding their sins and lets Jesus' healing balm unite us in greater strength than we can ask or imagine.